Tonight's talk, what I'd like to do with this is revisit some of the basic concepts of what suffering traditionally means in our particular practice, and distinguish that from how I think it's quite easy to become really comfortable and unchallenged in practice and slide into a definition of suffering that is completely conventional, that has to do with our personal narrative and our personal history and our personal story, which is actually something different than what the original teachings define as suffering. Related, and we have to learn how to apply the teachings to that, but as a fundamental definition of suffering, that's not what the traditional teachings are. So I'd like to talk about that and then give a couple of illustrations. So I want to go all the way back to the beginning, to the First Noble Truth that was taught by the Buddha, which is frequently translated as life is suffering. And if that were an accurate translation, if life were suffering, it would mean that suffering is inherent in life and we should just give up. Because if life is suffering, there's no escape from suffering. And so I think a more understandable explanation or definition of the First Noble Truth is that life as conventionally practiced or conventionally lived leads to suffering. Because we know from this practice, if you practiced at all, that you start to get a taste of what the Buddha was talking about in the sense of freedom, you know, that you've had something that's been plaguing you, and you begin meditating and begin using some of the steps on the Eightfold Path, and suddenly it's not plaguing you like it was before. The intensity has changed, the frequency of the suffering has changed, and in many cases, it just disappears. You know, something. I mean, I can, without too much trouble, make up a fairly good list of things that were really troubling me when I first started to practice, and now, you know, 30 years later, aren't even on my radar. They're not even an issue, and it's not because of the passage of time. It's because of this practice. So I think that this is really a fundamental and important concept, because it leads us to the conclusion that suffering has something to do with the way that we're living, the way that we're thinking, what we're saying, and how we're behaving. It's not hardwired. It's not something that's inherent. And this is a message of enormous hope that underlies all of the Buddhist teachings, is that there is the possibility of, you know, we hear the word liberation all the time, but another word that we could use is freedom, freedom from these things that plague us. And if we don't recognize that it has something to do with these fundamental ways that we're living and thinking and acting and speaking, then we're on the wheel that's depicted in the tanka, that's the farthest tanka on your right, which is the wheel of life, this wheel of samsara, where we're constantly repeating over and over and over again a series of deep emotional, psychological, and behavioral patterns that directly lead to suffering. It leads to a life of misery. And those ways of thinking and believing and acting and speaking lead to a whole secondary set of behaviors that cause us to suffer further, like avoidance, denial, just fundamental confusion about what's causing us to suffer or what leads us to happiness. So these fundamental ideas, I'm a strong believer that in the end this practice, in terms of its fundamentals, is quite simple. But the simplicity of it makes it so difficult, because we're talking about such fundamental things, you know, assumptions that we make that aren't even visible to us. Habits of mind that have become such deep habits that we just accept them as the way things are. Biases that we have that we don't even realize is a bias. Beliefs about the way the world is. You know, the world is an unsafe place, or whatever you want to fill in. And not even recognizing that that's a belief. Well, it's just the truth. And all of these things, unquestioned, is what causes us to suffering. I've always enjoyed the Wheel of Life, because I grew up in a household where my father was not a meditator, and he wasn't a Buddhist, but he was really interested in Oriental thought, and he was deeply into Asian martial arts. And so he introduced me to a lot of basic principles of a different way of seeing things, which is at the core of this practice, right? I mean, it's a different way of looking and understanding. And although this doesn't have anything to do with the Asian part of his interest, you've heard me say this before, he had a postcard that he kept up on his cabinet, his little cabinet where he would dress every morning. And it showed this is back in the 50s, you know, so this is where men always wore a suit and a hat. And he was a very dapper guy. He always wore a suit and a hat and a white shirt, and, you know. And so it shows a businessman like that on a gerbil wheel, you know. He's got a briefcase, you know. And underneath it says, if you win the rat race, you're still a rat. You know, so there's some things that we can do that we think are going to make us happy, and we get there and we find out, lo and behold, that we were deluded. Or we get what we wanted and we find out that it's not satisfying. And I think one way to think of this, and this is not the traditional definition, but it's helpful to me, is that the traditional definition goes all the way down to these very subtle forms of dissatisfaction and discontent, okay? And then it just escalates up or goes out in the spectrum from there. So the question, I think, for me is, well, from what does dissatisfaction and discontent arise? And, you know, we've been trained in this practice to say, oh, well, I know the answer to that. You know, it's desire and aversion and delusion and confusion, you know, these three core things, which is true. But another way to think of it is, if you think of the minor things, I mean, like the really throwaway things that irritate you, you know, at a minor level, make you dissatisfied. I mean, if you really think about it, what's behind that? And for me, it's a concept that for some unknown reason, that the world should perfectly adhere to what I prefer to happen. You know, it's this unbelievable, narcissistic, self-centered form of perfectionism. But it's not perfectionism towards yourself. It's perfectionism towards everything else, right? Like, every person who does something that irritates you, like, I mean, basically what your mind is saying, well, that's unbelievable. Why wouldn't they do it the way I do it? You know? They'd be much happier, and so would I. But, you know, there's not an illustration, I think, you know, I don't think anybody in this room can find an illustration that doesn't fit in there, you know? So for me, it's kind of shocking when you think of it that way, that it has to do with wanting things to be perfect that the outer world should conform to every desire and wish that we have. So if you think of it that way, to not do something about that, you have to know, leads to a life of misery. You know, there's no escape from that. If we don't do something about that, if we don't recognize, like, what is at the core of that deep assumption that's driving our dissatisfaction and discontent. So tonight I'm going to quote Aung San Suu Kyi several times, and as you may know, she's the basically was and still is, I guess, even though they claim that the government has changed, the opposition leader with the National League of Democracy in Burma. And, you know, for me, she is this extraordinary illustration of Dharma principles in action. She was has spent well over a decade in house arrest on multiple occasions. They have passed special laws to basically ban her family from being with her in Burma. She cannot, if she leaves the country, she can never come back into the country. So like her husband was deathly ill. And she knew that if she left the country, she was in England. And the family was in England, and she's on house arrest in Burma. And she knew that if she left the country, she'd never be able to come back again, and had to make the choice between her country and her family. And just extraordinary. And so she's a real inspiration to me, because and what I'm about to say is not in any way a criticism of the Dalai Lama. Okay, but. In fact, if you go into our office, there's a picture of the Dalai Lama and her together. You know, for me, they're these two big spiritual/political figures in the world. But one of the differences is where the Dalai Lama fled Tibet, and for obvious reasons at a very young life, she refused to flee Burma, where she could have. And she's paid this enormous price to do so. And she is now the leader of the opposition government, which people think is going to transform this place over a period of years. But it's a lifetime of work, and she knows that. But so I'm going to quote her a couple times tonight. It's from a book that I really encourage you to look at, because it is so helpful in answering the question, well, what type of attitudes should I be holding as a Buddhist practitioner in the face of the chaos and political discontent that's taking place in our country right now? Okay? You know, when I'm seeing things that, from my perspective, I think are inappropriate or hurting people, you know, well, what should my attitudes be? Well, this is not philosophy. You know, this is like real life. I mean, everything she has to say is born out of the Buddhist teachings that you do not give anybody else any advice, and you don't draw any conclusions in your own mind about your own suffering, other than based on your own direct experience that proves to be true, not intellectually, but experientially, and it's consistent with what the wise, you know, the senior practitioners of this practice would also approve. And you read these interviews, and she doesn't have to say it, you just hear it over and over and over again. I mean, this is really inspirational material. So it's called The Voice of Hope, Conversations with Aung San Suu Kyi with Alan Clements. Alan Clements was a student of Upandita, the same as Kalama Masters was. He's kind of a maverick. He left the monastery there and said a lot of controversial things. But he, in his own way, is quite an inspirational figure as well, although controversial. But this is a book worth looking at. Okay, so back to this topic about a perfect world. We can't get free at this level unless we get free at a larger level. You know, Buddhist practice fundamentally is saying all of the time things may be different than they appear. You know, and the paren or after that is, and it's almost always the case that they are different than they appear, even though you're saying may, okay? Because we're looking at it from a deeper level. So unless we make fundamental structural changes in the way that we're approaching issues and understanding issues, we can't overcome these deep habits of wanting things to be the way we want them to be all the time. So this is one of the things. I didn't get back home last night until 11:30 from a long day in Los Angeles on a plane, and when I get tired, I have trouble seeing. So she says, don't think of yourself as being unfortunate for having to live in these times. Think of it as fortunate because you have an opportunity to work for justice and the welfare of other people. This is the sort of opportunity that doesn't come along very often. Now, the thing I want to stress about this is, you know, this isn't philosophy. This isn't some rosy, rose-colored glasses view of things. This is a person who has fundamentally lost the better part of her adult life in house arrest, has all of her friends being imprisoned, tortured, many of them killed. And so she means this. That's the kind of deep structural change in our thinking that we're talking about. I mean, this comes from the type of deep acceptance. You know, this isn't tolerating things. This isn't just adapting to them. This is accepting what? The way things actually are at the deepest level, and then allowing that to generate an entirely new vision of how our think and believe and relate to the world. You know, I mean, this is a profound thing, and I actually think it's hard for us to understand because these assumptions and prejudices and biases and ways of thinking are so deep. Okay, so the traditional definitions of suffering. So basically there's three of them that I want to go over. So the first one is bodily or mental feelings of pain as actually felt in the body or mind. Okay? Bodily or mental feelings of pain as actually felt in the mind. So the importance of that definition is that it is not intellectual or conceptual. It is as actually felt in the body, but as felt in the mind. You know, so I think one of the big shift for practitioners is actually recognizing and being mindful of and inquiring in to a feeling that is in the mind. In Buddhism, we treat the mind as the sixth sense door. So in the same way that your skin has, you know, all of these sense receptors. And so when something sharp is on your leg, you feel it, it feels painful. We can feel pain in the mind itself. And that has a particular feeling in there. Different things have different kinds of painful feelings in the mind. Okay, so I certainly didn't plan on this happening, but while I was sitting tonight, I found myself ruminating and a lot of papancha over something that's happened in the last several days that feels pretty outrageous that you can hear the perfect mind speaking now. That feels pretty outrageous that somebody else did, you know, that I find unacceptable. And rather than, you know, my mind saying, well, you know, that's pretty unacceptable and I'll deal with it, you know, I kept waking up to my mind generating all of these scenarios, you know, and trying to practice, you know, I shifted from the story to like, well, what actually is happening in my mind? And what I noticed was like my mind felt like so constricted and so tight, and that feeling was so painful. And if I didn't see it and kind of sit with it and let it go, it started becoming a headache. You know, it started radiating out because the tension was so strong. But this is an object of meditation, and a really important object of meditation. When we talk about sensation in the body, we mean sensation in the body and mind. It's an integrated circuit. So the first one is bodily or mental feelings of pain as actually felt. The second one is the fundamentally unsatisfactory nature and the general insecurity of all conditioned phenomena, basically all things, because they change. This is the principle of anicca or impermanence, okay? So why does it create general unsatisfactoriness? Well, if we want something to be a certain way and it changes, normally we find it unsatisfactory. We can put all different kinds of words on it, but at its core, it's unsatisfactory. And that creates this deep intuitive knowledge that everything's going to change, and so that there's nothing that we can fundamentally rely on. Now, we go through all these kinds of rationalizations to defend ourselves from that, right? It's like everybody else is going to get cancer. Everybody else is going to get hit by a car. It's not going to happen to me, you know, until it's you and then, or me. And then it's like, well, gee, it really is true. Everything is subject to change, including me, and here it is. But until that moment, the way conventionally that the mind works is to set up all these defenses against the true nature of things as they really are. And I'm going to tie this in just a second with one big belief. So the second traditional definition is this fundamental unsatisfactoriness. It relates to this notion of perfection, of wanting things to be a particular way. And we can never have them that way, ever, because everything's going to change. Nothing will ever remain the way it is, ever. It may be for a while. But, and if you know, if you can find an exception, let's talk about it. You know? Okay. The third one is a sense of an independent self, disassociated or disconnected from the conditions that cause the sense of separation and self to arise. Okay. So, you know, we describe this as dependent origination, you know, this process of reactivity, but the fundamental, you know, we can go through all the steps, but the fundamental thing that happens is that at some point, as a result of desire and aversion and attachment, that we begin to separate from our experience. You know, it's so like I'm in a discussion with you, you know, and it's just happening, right? I mean, like, we're just right there, right there. No defense. You know, we're feeling connected. Right? This whole thing is happening transactionally. And then somebody says something. And what happens? you know, one of us starts to withdraw, you know, one of us starts to put this thing up, and this sense of separation, which eventually becomes an identity, you know, like they said something that's offensive to me or threatening me or problematic to me, okay? So the, and of course, this is, this and the second one are at the core of all suffering. Because who is it that wants the perfect world? It's me. It's this separated sense of self, disconnected from the reality that everything is changing and will never be that way, and doesn't want to acknowledge it. Okay. So those are the three fundamental things, and then those translate out into all our different forms of dissatisfaction. Everything traces back to those. Okay. Now, the fascinating thing about this is, what is the focal point of these three things? And maybe what's helpful is to start with what it's not. Okay. There's nothing in those three descriptions about all of our problems are the result of our family of origin. They're not about our personal narrative. They're not about our personal story. You know, all of that is another form of this perfectionist drive that says something like, if only this hadn't happened to me, I wouldn't be experiencing this kind of suffering. So that's not to say that our personal narrative and our family of origin issues aren't huge and really important, and we have to deal with them in real time. Okay? What it is to say is that's not the fundamental focus of this practice. This practice dives down beneath those, and the reason is we're trying to undermine our identification with that, because that's where our suffering comes from. So as long as we are attached to and identified with those things, we can never get free. It will always be a source of suffering. No way around it. So this is the reason, now we're hooking things up. You know, we talk about mindfulness being moment-to-moment non-judgmental awareness, right? Like, and anybody who's been on a retreat, we talk about creating a continuity of mindfulness, moment after moment after moment, okay? Well, why is that? I mean, like, mindfulness must have something to do with suffering, right? Because the first noble truth is life is about suffering. So it's not like, you know, now we have mindfulness that is completely separated from the original teachings of the historical Buddha, and it becomes something separate and their own, you know. But when we're here, we're talking about the Buddhist idea of mindfulness as connected with the original teachings and with suffering. So what does this moment-to-moment mindfulness have to do with those three causes of suffering? And the answer is, when is the suffering occurring? It's occurring right now. You know, it's not occurring in the past, and it's not projecting out into the future. It's right now in this moment, and there is a mechanism underneath our personal narrative that is causing us to suffer. That has to do with attachment and identification, so that the way that we get liberated from that is being in the moment and doing experiential inquiry into our own experience. Like, what is it that is causing us to suffer? So when we start to do this kind of inquiry, we see that it is not the thought that we were having. It's not the external circumstance. It's the way that we're relating to it and the way that we see it and understand it. Okay? Is this working so far? You notice I didn't ask you if you like it. or your mind likes it. Okay. So, this brings me to kind of the next fundamental principle that I want to talk about, and that is that the one of the fundamental natures of this practice is experiential inquiry. So, mindfulness is a thing in and of itself, but it is not the whole package. If it was, there wouldn't be an Eightfold Path. Mindfulness is one element of the Eightfold Path, very important one, and it kind of acts as a gatekeeper for everything else, but it's not the whole package, okay? So this element of being mindful of observing and experiencing in a way that is inquiry, experiential inquiry. What is the cause of my suffering? If you take that out of the practice, well, what do we have? Well, what are we mindful of? I guess we're mindful of things changing and moving and what have you, but we're not getting to the point of practice of like, well, why are all those things causing suffering? So the inquiry, this experiential inquiry, is absolutely critical. And Thomas Merton wasn't a Buddhist. He was a Catholic mystic. He was a but many things, not all things, but many things that he had to say, I think, are completely resonant with our practice. And this is one of them. He said, "This is precisely the monk's chief service to the world, this listening, this questioning, this humble and courageous exposure to what the world ignores." This listening, this questioning, this humble and courageous exposure to what the world ignores. And in the West, we're trying to do things that were pretty much limited to monastics in Asia. So, this notion of seeing things clearly as they are is about what's below the surface. And the Buddha was, very clear that he felt this approach to things would always be swimming against the stream of society. And that's exactly what Merton is saying, this humble and courageous exposure to what the world ignores. This is very difficult work to look at our life this way. And it can be very painful. But if mindfulness is moment-to-moment awareness and has a continuity, then this inquiry is a lifelong open inquiry into our life about what's causing our suffering or happiness in any moment. Okay. So one of the common problems that I think we all run into, we kind of fall into ruts, and as a teacher, when we do interviews, we commonly see that students will come in and this inquiry and mindfulness being linked up isn't happening. And one of two things has happened, that inquiry's taking place, but it's disconnected from these fundamental fundamental teachings. That the inquiry is about something else. It's about what are all the things out there in my life that are causing me to suffer? Where the inquiry should be, well, what's happening in here that's causing me to view those things as causing me to suffer? Okay. So they've become disconnected from the teachings, or just the inquiry's completely stopped. And people are sitting in meditation and they're practicing to feel comfortable, to be unchallenged, or to try to create a world where they are comfortable and unchallenged and they're safe, and which is just the reverse. Like if you're willing to open to this, Ram Dass always used to talk about how Initially, when he came to practice, the idea that you would open to your own suffering just scared him to death, because he assumed that if you opened to your own suffering, it would just overwhelm you. You know, it would be like the dam's broken, and you know, you would be lost. And then he goes on to say, and actually, it's just the reverse. You know, when you're willing to do this humble and courageous inquiry that the world turns away from, it's such a sense of relief to actually begin to understand what it is that's causing you to suffer, because then you have hope. You know, where before you're kind of scrambling around trying to hold things off or tolerate things or, you know, make things better, and they just keep repeating themselves over and over again. You keep struggling. But when you actually are willing to let down the shield and open, as scary as it is, you know, like, it changes everything. So I want to talk about, use three illustrations about inquiry being disconnected from basic practice principles or dharmic principles. So the first one, the starting place on all of these is, we have all heard, and whether or not we really know it is another thing, but we've all heard that the primary driver of karma, of the pointing of the mind either towards suffering, which would be bad karma, or towards happiness and satisfaction, which would be good karma, is our intention. Because our intention drives our thinking, which drives our behavior and drives our speech. Okay? So let's deal with right speech. What I find is the most common, conventional way that people approach issues is, I say, okay, well, you know, should we engage in right speech? What do you think? You know, like, supposedly a practitioner. And the first response that the mind for most people will have is not like, well, gee, that's really would be inspiring. That would really be great. The first response is to come up with all of the obstacles to engaging in right speech. Well, gosh, if I were just truthful all the time, you know, I can think of so many illustrations where if I were actually truthful, it would be such a problem. And, you know, it just goes on and on. You know, you can come up with it. Rather than saying, well, what do I want my true intention as a human being on this planet to be? But yeah, no, I want to engage in right speech because it'll change my life. It'll change my relationships with other people. It'd be a really valuable thing. And then you go to, well, what are going to be the issues? How do I implement right speech in my life? And, you know, by the way, right speech doesn't mean, and the Buddha never said, that in every single situation you have to tell the truth. You know, he's pretty clear that there are times when to be completely truthful is actually very destructive. So that doesn't mean that the option is lying. You know, you do something other than that. But so many of the obstacles that the minds raise are just ways to avoid making a commitment. And so there's a huge difference between having an intention. I mean, like, I've really thought about it. And my deepest intention is to engage in right speech, and now I'm going to figure out how to implement it, as opposed to having not having made that intention, set that intention, that commitment, and trying to engage in right speech. Because it's like a tree with no roots. Like, well, what's driving the right speech? Well, it's an idea that, well, it would be great to engage in right speech. It's not an intention. You know, so This is Aung San Suu Kyi again, and she says, I've never thought of myself as particularly confident. What I do know is that I want to do what is right. I don't claim that what I'm doing is always right, but I know for a fact that my intentions are good and that I don't want to hurt anyone. And then she talks about what a comfort that is. And then when she gets in a situation, you know, where she starts to get reactive and, you know, they just find out somebody's been killed or tortured or she's being slandered, as it happens almost every day, she has something to fall back on. This deep intention not to hurt anybody, you know. So if you don't have that intention, you don't have anything to fall back on. You got all this reactivity, and you've got nothing inside of yourself arising from here out that is a support. Okay. So, okay, second illustration has to do with non-harming, and it's basically I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it, but it's basically the same idea. I mean, it's a beautiful idea. Nonviolence is an inspirational idea, but if you haven't spent time with it, if you haven't really reflected on it and meditated on it and then brought that in structurally as a deep intention, all it is an idea. There are going to be all kinds of times where rather than instinctually acting out of this deep intention, that's what starts to happen. It's an intuitive response to the world. It's an instinctual response to the world because it is your deepest intention. So if you don't have that, it's really easy to say or do something that is really harmful or violent, psychologically, emotionally, physically. Last illustration on this has to do with a reincarnation. Okay, so a couple sessions ago, I kind of talked about the Buddhist idea of rebirth or reincarnation, and you know, this is a point of it's a hot topic in a lot of Buddhist circles, and it seems like the prevailing theory is that, well, either you know you have faith and you believe in it, or you don't. And if I don't, I'm a secular Buddhist. And so it's as if it's untrue, okay? It's like, well, gee, you know, I really thought about it. It doesn't make any sense. You know, I believe that when I die, you know, there's no rebirth, okay? And, like, we actually believe that, okay? So the thing that strikes me about this way of thinking is, you know, it's fundamental in Buddhism, the dualistic thinking. The minute you see yourself thinking dualistically, that there's something wrong with it. Because the world is not either or. And from a Buddhist perspective, it's all about inquiry. And the minute you start investigating things, everything becomes a spectrum. Okay? So, does anybody have an idea what might be another reasonable option of, well, rebirth has to be true, or rebirth is untrue? I mean, is there any principle at all that we might have heard before that might be relevant here?
Say you don't know.
Yeah. I mean, like this fundamental state of mind that is supposed to undermine all of our practice. It undermines mindfulness. Like, I don't know. That's the reason I'm being mindful. I'm going to watch an inquiry and see what arises out of that. That's where my direct intuitive knowledge comes from a Buddhist perspective, not from my intellect. Okay? And the Buddha even says that, you know, this very famous Kalama Sutta. And in the second half of it, he talks about this issue. He says, well, there's these, all these big issues. You know, is there a life after death? Is there a self after death or not a self after death? And he basically says, listen, you're never going to figure that out intellectually. You know, you can be thinking about this and, you know, trying to figure, never going to happen. So all you're doing by doing that is suffering. So just practice. And if you practice and you follow the precepts, you'll live the best life you can. And if it's true that there's rebirth, having lived the best life you could, according to these principles, you'll have a good rebirth. And if it turns out it's untrue, you'll have lived the best life you could. Now, see, this is not to the mind that wants things to be perfect, you know, the way I want them to be. What underlies that is that mind wants to be certain about everything. That mind wants to know everything because that makes that mind believe falsely that it is safe. And then that mind lives in a body that gets cancer. And then it's like, gee, I thought I was safe. You know. So this don't know mind underlies everything. And this is, frankly, I mean, personally, this is very frightening. To give up the idea that I can know or be certain about things. So, you know, my grandson is a great teacher for me because he doesn't, you know, there's no intellectual rejection of anything yet, right? It's like he doesn't know intellectually. So it's all about observation and experience. It's fantastic. It's just a constant reminder for me. And, you know, he's a living illustration of, I just don't know. So I'm going to try it out and I'm going to find out what happens, you know. And some of that's good and some of that's bad. You know, his favorite movie right now is Ice Age. Okay, and which is a beautiful little movie for a child. You know, it's such a beautiful story, and you know, there's these different beings of different types in the Ice Age, and they become a herd, even though they're totally different. Right? It's a diversity story. You know, it's fantastic. So he's watched this many times, and so he I'll watch it with him sometimes, and he actually knows the line that's coming before it happens, and we'll say it before it happens, and he'll even physically act it out. So there's a scene where the sloth, whose name is, sloth and torpor, his name is Sid, and there's these two kind of rhinoceros-looking animals, and he kind of has, you know, a difficult interchange with them, and as they walk away, he says to them something about wide bodies, okay? You know, kind of pejoratively. So the other day, I'm with my grandson, and he's in the back seat in his little seat. And we're coming across the J Street Bridge in Fair Oaks, and you know, you get to that point, and there's sidewalks on that the right hand side of the road, and there is this woman who is a very 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 big. She's obese, you know. And he says to me, Poppy, a wide body. So I'm hoping that he's going to get some intellectual recognition of things at some level here soon. But this notion of, you know, I don't know, you know, I don't know mind / beginner's mind, you know, isn't an idea. It's a fundamental of practice. You know, so with all of these things that I'm throwing out, it's really provocative to me, and I ask myself a lot, you know, like, am I doing that? You know, in my life, in my sitting, you know, as I try to apply the precepts and all of those things. And, you know, I see in my own mind how entrenched my mind is to not do these things. You know, the habits are so deep. So, okay, so those are being disconnected from. And then the last one I want to do, which I think is going to be pretty short because we're all familiar with this, but I'm hoping we're hearing it a little bit differently. is practicing without inquiry. And this is a little different than what it sounds like, because it sounds like practicing without inquiry means that, well, you're practicing without inquiry. And what it really means, and I'm referring to the Kalama Sutta here, is that we're practicing without the kind of inquiry which is direct experiential inquiry. Okay? So in that sutta, the Buddha goes into this town, Kalama, which is kind of a point where a lot of spiritual teachers come through. And apparently in the day, everybody was relatively critical of everybody else. In fact, if you go through the, you know, everybody talks about non-judgmental awareness and speech and everything. If you go through the suttas, you know, the Buddha named 44 competing sects or teachers and says quite clearly they're all wrong. You know, he did not hesitate at all. I mean, he wasn't nasty about it, but it wasn't like, well, gee, all paths lead up the mountain, lead to the same place. You know, I mean, he really named them specifically. So here, the Kalamas, he's giving this talk, and they're basically saying to him, geez, you know, all these people are coming through, and everybody says they're right. So why should we believe you? How do we know you're right? What's the standard? And this, in my opinion, is a really misunderstood sutta. And basically what he says, well, you should rely on your own experience. That's what you hear all the time. And that's kind of right. But once again, if you disconnect, rely on your own experience from the fundamentals of practice, they mean different things. You know, just, well, your own experience, well, that could mean, you know, my intellectual experience, you know, the way I interpret things through my family history, you know, whatever. Well, that's not what he meant. So he gives this list and he says, these, he says, having belief or acceptance without sufficient experiential inquiry or examination to know if that belief or acceptance is justified. Okay. That you should not do any of the following. None of the following should be the basis for belief or acceptance which you would stake your spiritual life on, practice your spiritual life. First of all, the scriptures of any particular teachings, including his own. Logical reasoning. It's intellectual. Inferential reasoning. Exclusively intellectual. What he called reasoned cognition. Thinking things through. Arriving at a view after pondering it. Just reflecting on it. An oral tradition. You know, it's not written down in any place, but there's a series of teachings that are conveyed orally. Believing or accepting something because of the authority or competence of the speaker or the presenter, including himself, including anybody who sits up here, or that the presenter or speaker is your teacher or your guru, you know, at that time. So he says, all of those are not a basis. So I kind of look at that list and I go, gee, that kind of looks like an awful lot of my decision making. You know. But I mean, it's dramatic if you look at that list, if you print it out and look at it. It's like, wow, you know, like you hook that up with those three definitions of suffering. And the practice starts to mean something than just the way we are normally living our lives. You know, it takes us all the way back to there is something about the way that we are normally thinking, behaving, speaking, and acting that is causing us to suffer. And these, the Buddha says, are the things. Relying exclusively on intellectual reasoning and logic to arrive at a conclusion and then acting on it. And I'll bet if we took 10 minutes and I just said, okay, what I would like everyone in the room to do is just for 10 minutes, just select, find one thing where you really, really thought something through. You reflected on it, you reasoned, you know, the whole deal, and you were confident that this was really good, the right decision, that it would lead to your being satisfied, and you know, great decision. And it turned out to be totally wrong. You know, all of us can figure that out, okay? And so the Buddha is saying that if you use, you know, this is a fully integrated circuit, if you use just one part of it, you will never be able to get to the right place. And so this direct experience, which may take quite a while, okay, but direct experience in meditation, direct experience in the sense of trying to practice the precepts and see what happens, seeing if you try to practice the precepts without developing an intention first, does that actually work? That this is the standard, okay? And the second part is that what you decide, how you decide to proceed, is consistent with what the elders, you know, the wise members of the Sangha would endorse or believe is consistent with the teachings. Because the other piece is that our minds will rationalize anything. You know, they will get us to what we want. With just shamelessly, you know, so that in addition to really deeply looking at our own experience, along the way we want to be making an inquiry of what the elders of the community, the respected teachers would advise. So I think the conclusion of this for me is another Thomas Merton quotation. A lot of people said this, but I like it because he said it. And you know, he said that the purpose of spiritual life, that spiritual life should be dangerous. And, you know, if you think about it, the Buddha said, he didn't use that word, but he said the same thing. He said, you know, what we're trying to do is we're trying to undermine our sense of self. I mean, like, that's a pretty dramatic idea. You know, like the fundamental thing, you know, that we think, that our minds think, that we're basing our life on. That what we're actually trying to do is undermine that. To start to loosen that up, you know, to loosen up these deep attachments. And then as we start to do that, we start to feel lighter and freer, and we start to get a glimpse, a little taste of freedom. It's just a little taste. And the minute you have that, it's like, wow, it might be true that things could really be different. You know, that's the message of the Buddha. Things could really be different. Yeah. So... okay, so we've got time for a couple of questions if there are any questions or comments or dissents or... all with the right speech.
So what you're saying is that without our experience of whatever, then we can't really know the reality or the truth. We have to have an experience of that. What you're saying.
Okay. So my understanding of what the Buddha said is that in order for us to determine what causes us to suffer or what points our mind towards satisfaction and contentment is our own direct experience and experiential inquiry into what causes us to suffer and what points our mind or causes us to feel satisfaction. And if we try to do that only intellectually, and we use that as the primary tool, that we're on the wrong track. That doesn't mean that that intellectually working through things isn't important, but that by itself will never get us there, and the thing that actually will give us a taste of freedom and eventually produce insight. Now, that was last talk I gave, that this inquiry process produces this spontaneous insight, is this direct inquiry through experience.
So then, that just seems overwhelming to me. And dependent on where you take your life, so to speak, and it has, if we have to experience, there's so much in the world to experience.
Okay, I'm going to stop you right now.
All right.
Okay, and none of this is personal, my comments, right? Okay, so here's an illustration of what I was saying. It's like we're starting to come up with all the problems to doing it, as opposed to saying, wow, I really get it. Like, if I don't do that, I can't get free. So how do I do it? Mm-hmm. Okay? The mind wants to go, geez, that's overwhelming. I can't do that. There's so many experiences. Well, there aren't so many experiences. The only experience that's important from the standpoint of Buddhism is the experience that's occurring right now in this moment. And watching it, and then watching the next one, and seeing what's actually happening. Okay, like right now, are you feeling really satisfied that we're having this discussion? Or are you feeling defensive or confused? And so, how did that happen experientially? Okay, so just staying with our experience in the moment. The intellect wants to go, oh my gosh, there's so much. And then what happens? We're disconnected from the present moment. Right? Yeah, so the intellect will always do this to us. And then the minute we do that, we're off on suffering. Because, the idea that, this practice that I've been doing actually is completely overwhelming. There's so many, that's a pretty painful thought. A totally understandable thought. But a painful one, and a good illustration of how our mind kind of does it to us. Like, every time you see yourself starting to go there, just come back here. That's the message. Just keep coming back here. Yeah, over and over and over again, moment to moment, non-judgmental inquiry, continuity of that for a lifetime. Wow, that sounds simple. So. Okay, so Michael.
It's not a very deep question. Isn't this kind of mind wanting to go up into the mind and think about it? Doesn't the Buddha say somewhere that this is the primary way that the mind defends itself against experience? Or
yep.
It's kind of like tries to shut it out? Or
yeah, that's the Honeyball Sutta. Uh-huh. Yeah, he says that's the primary way not to feel in the body, and it's the primary way that we begin selfing, creating a self, is by that shift, not staying here, not staying in our experience, but moving, just up here entirely into the intellect, and then we immediately start moving into separation and selfing. Yeah. Okay, so listen, thank you very much for coming tonight. I hope that this was helpful in some way, and I have this deep hope and actually a belief that all of our efforts together will have an impact in the world, and may all beings everywhere be free of suffering and really experience the freedom, the sense of deep relief and happiness associated with not suffering. So, okay, thank you.